From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now! The Israeli military invades the West Bank cities of Bethlehem, Jenin, and other places, also bombs Gaza Strip. We'll go to Jenin as well as Gaza, and we'll talk with a reporter who just interviewed a soldier describing his role in the destruction of the Jenin refugee camp. Then, here at home in domestic news, we'll look at the GOP fundraiser last night. Republican Congress member left a prescription drug debate early to attend the GOP gala, where drug companies paid up to $250,000 apiece for a place at the table. We'll speak with Congressmember Bernie Sanders. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Israeli armed forces have bombed Gaza City and invaded Bethlehem, Jenin, and its refugee camp, Nablus, Ramallah, Qalqilya, Hebron, and Dura. The attacks come after a second suicide bomb attack in Jerusalem in 2 days, which killed 6 Israelis and injured over 30. More on that in a few minutes. U.S.-backed Hamid Karzai was sworn in as president of Afghanistan amid controversy Wednesday after he asked delegates to the Grand Council to approve his new cabinet with a show of hands rather than a vote. Many delegates reacted angrily, said the show of hands was far from convincing. The London Telegraph reports diplomats had warned Karzai that circumventing formal approval from the lawyer Jirga might cause trouble in the future, but it appears he was willing to face that prospect rather than risk rejection of his cabinet. The London Guardian's reporting the British government approved arms sales to India and Pakistan throughout the Kashmir crisis. In parliamentary proceedings that have just come to light, the government sanctioned exports of bombs, torpedoes, rockets, missiles, combat vessels, howitzers, and military aircraft and their components. Only last week, Foreign Secretary Jack Straw told parliamentarians, "On the issue of arms sales to India and Pakistan, I may be wrong, but I do not recall approving a single arms control license in the past." Last 2 months. In domestic news, the Sonoma County Sheriff's Department has agreed to pay $1 million settlement in the landmark civil rights lawsuit Maria Teresa Macias versus Sonoma County Sheriff Mark Ide. It is the first ever monetary award by law enforcement for their failure to protect a domestic violence victim leading to her murder. The announcement came mid-trial at the close of dramatic testimony by Sara Rubio Hernandez. She described how Macias tried more than 20 times in the last few months of her life to get protection from her violent, estranged husband. He finally shot and killed her in 1996. The U.S. government argued Wednesday it's perfectly legal to hold a U.S. citizen in custody without filing charges against him and without giving him access to a lawyer. U.S. Attorney Paul McNulty made the argument in connection with Yasser Assam Hamdi, who was born in Louisiana, raised in Saudi Arabia, and captured on the battlefield in Afghanistan. Hamdi is currently imprisoned on a naval brig in Virginia. A lower court ruled Hamdi should have unrestricted access to a court-appointed public defender. McNulty challenged the ruling, arguing the military has the right to capture and imprison people if they're enemy combatants and that combatants have no right to a lawyer. The Reverend Jerry Falwell and other leading evangelical Christians are supporting a prominent Southern Baptist preacher's condemnation of the prophet Muhammad as a, quote, demon-possessed pedophile. Former president of the Southern Baptist Convention, Reverend Jerry Vines, said ahead of the annual meeting that religious pluralism is responsible for many of the country's problems. He said, quote, they would have us believe that Islam is just as good as Christianity. Christianity was founded by the virgin-born son of God, Jesus Christ. Islam was founded by Muhammad, a demon-possessed pedophile who had 12 wives, the last one of which was a 9-year-old girl, Vines said. The very next day, President Bush addressed the convention via satellite, praising it for its tradition of tolerance. Meanwhile, the Associated Press is reporting a grand jury has been investigating whether Boston's Roman Catholic cardinal and other church leaders broke the law by quietly shuffling priests accused of molesting children from parish to parish. The Federal Election Commission Wednesday adopted regulations governing enforcement of the new McCain-Feingold campaign finance law that the commission's own general counsel warned could undermine the government's ability to limit the use of soft money. The new law prohibits parties from raising or soliciting large unregulated soft money donations, but the commission voted to adopt such a narrow definition of solicit that the FEC won't be able to penalize elected officials unless they explicitly ask for a soft money contribution from one of those groups. Democratic Commissioner Carl Sandstrom admitted this will allow lawmakers to suggest they want a contribution with a wink and a nod. But he said, quote, "We're on dangerous ground when we start prosecuting winks and nods." FEC General Counsel Lawrence Norton said the Sandstrom amendment weakens a core purpose of the McCain-Feingold law, which is to prevent federal officials from raising soft money and directing others to make soft money contributions. And the nation's biggest tobacco company suffered their first defeat in a secondhand smoke case last week. A Miami jury on Tuesday awarded over $5 million to Lynn French, a flight attendant who does not smoke but has chronic sinus problems from spending more than a dozen years in a smoky airplane cabin. She is one of nearly 3,000 flight attendants with similar cases against the tobacco industry.
Communication is the only way. Start saying what you mean to say. All your troubles are gonna run away. Start saying what you mean to say. Communication is the only way. Start saying what you mean to say. All your troubles gonna run away. Start saying what you mean today. Communication is the only way. Start saying what you mean to say. All your troubles gonna run away. Start saying what you mean today.
Communication. Bella Fleck on the Flecktones here on Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, joined by El Presidente, Juan Gonzalez. Welcome, Juan.
Good day, Amy, and to our listeners around the country. And it's also my it's my daughter's my youngest daughter's third birthday today. So I want to say happy birthday to Gabriela out there, who is, I think, is listening this morning.
Happy birthday, Gabriela. That's a tremendous accomplishment, one that doesn't quite compare, but that is pretty impressive, Juan, is that you have just won the election for president of the National Association of Hispanic Journalists.
Yeah, it was an upset victory, I'm told, because I was not the candidate of the old board of directors and the outgoing president, but won pretty handily, I think. So it was quite a surprise to some of the other folks within the our 20th convention of the National Association of Hispanic
Journalists. Can you talk about the organization?
Well, the group was founded. I was actually one of the founding members back 20 years ago, as a professional organization to advocate for greater employment opportunities for Latinos in the American media, as well as for to improve the coverage of Latinos by the mass media. But I think I ran on a platform that we have really not substantially or qualitatively changed the condition of Latinos within the industry or the coverage of the Latino community over the last 20 years, and that we needed to adopt a much more aggressive advocacy position to be able to deal with the growing concentration of the media and its impact, the rise of corporate conglomerates within the journalism profession, and how that was affecting and causing a decline in the quality of journalism, as well as a threat to American democracy, and that the American people are not getting sufficient numbers of diverse views. So that was pretty much my platform, and it resonated very well among all the journalists. And even though I was opposed by by some of the people who have been sort of in the leadership and the administration. I mean, they're very good people, but they're sort of like timid in the way they approach and challenge the industry as a whole. But I got a pretty big support from a lot of the veteran Latino journalists around the country, like Ray Suarez of the Laird NewsHour and a bunch of the veteran journalists over at the LA Times, Frank Del Olmo and Frank Sotomayor and Maria Hinojosa from CNN and John Quiñones from ABC. A lot of the most well-known veteran journalists were all backing me and are all very disturbed about what's going on in the corporate media as a whole in terms of what kind of information the American people are getting. And so I tried to link the failures of affirmative action and changing coverage with the overall trends of the media in the country in terms of corporate conglomerates.
Uh-huh. And the media executives, their stand on your campaign?
Well, I don't think they were too happy. In fact, I saw Tony Ritter, who is the head of the Knight Ritter newspaper company. They own the San Jose Mercury, the Miami Herald, the Philadelphia Inquirer, and a bunch of other papers. He was walking around carrying a button for my opponent, even though he can't vote. So he was actively lobbying.
That's a get rid of Juan.
His employees. He was actively lobbying his employees to vote for my opponent. And the CEO of the Tribune, the Chicago Tribune, LA Times Empire was there as well. And
well, how do you propose to take on the media conglomerates?
We're in the process now of sort of developing an overall strategy with the new board of directors, because I was not the only one newly elected. A whole group of insurgents got elected to the board of directors, including a vice president for broadcasting, a vice president for print, a new representative for online media to the board of directors. And we're going to be putting together a strategy, but basically it's going to entail having a lot more visibility in terms of advocacy before these companies. I think we're going to begin a whole new initiative that the NIHJ has never done before of going after the magazine industry, which is a huge part of the mass media but has been largely left aside in terms of its coverage of the Latino community as well as its affirmative action record. It's going to take us a few months to put the overall strategy together. But the main shift will be that we're going to be concentrating much more on how the rise of corporate conglomerates is affecting the quality of journalism and is affecting coverage of minorities and employment opportunities for minorities.
And where does the internet fit into this?
Clearly, all newspapers and television stations have developed online components. They have lots of people working there. In addition to all of the independent internet news sources that have developed, and there's been really no attempt to ascertain who's being employed in these industries, how is the work that the online news organizations are doing, how does that relate to the Black and Latino and Asian communities of the country, how well are they covering them. So we're going to begin a much more systematic process of analyzing both magazines and on the online news industry, as well as the traditional old radio, TV, and newspaper sectors of the industry.
And then how are you going to be organizing with the National Association of Black Journalists, Native American Journalists, Latino Asian Journalists?
Well, interestingly, I'm going to be president for 2 years. Next year, our annual convention is going to be in New York City, in the media capital of the world, so it's going to get a much more attention. But the following year, 2004, is the year for what we call unity among the various minority journalist groups. That's when the National Association of Black Journalists, Asian Journalists, our group, and the Native American Journalist Organization all have a joint convention. It's called Unity. It's the largest gathering of journalists in American history. It's happened twice before, in 94 in Atlanta and in 99 in Seattle. But in 2004, it's going to be in Washington, D.C., in the nation's capital. It'll be an election year. And I'm sure that the gathering of 7,000 journalists in Washington, D.C., is going to attract a lot of attention from the political forces.
Well, I remember the political candidates for president, Gore and Bush, came out to the Unity Conference in Seattle.
Yes. And I think that I'll be president of the NIHJ going into that convention. That'll be sort of like the end of my term, and I'm hoping that we'll be able to make it a little bit more of a convention that holds both the media companies and the politicians accountable than has happened in the past.
Well, Juan, while you were gone, you weren't really gone, because we got in the mail from the New Press, your new book that has just been published, Fallout, The Environmental Consequences of the World Trade Center Collapse. So congratulations on this book being published.
Thanks. Yeah, it just came into the bookstores, I think, this week. So it's just news of it is just spreading around. But given everything that's been happening, well, even while I was gone, they found in Stuyvesant High School, which I've reported upon repeatedly, the Board of Education admitted astronomical levels of lead in the dust in the duct system of Stuyvesant High School. And they actually kept that secret for 2 months because they actually did the tests in April and didn't release them until, like, I think it was last Thursday.
And when did the kids and teachers go back?
They went back last October 9th, and they've been in that school now for all this time with a lot of lead in the dust reported, but now for the first time the school board is admitting that the whole duct system is contaminated with lead dust. But they were able to keep delaying doing the testing, getting the information, so now they can claim, well, the summer's here, we'll clean it up all over the summer. But meanwhile, 3,000 students were exposed to this this potential health hazard for almost a full school year.
A lot of absenteeism, a lot of unexplained nosebleeds, terrible headaches, rashes, teachers moving out of that school to go to others because they just couldn't make it through the day there. Well, Stuyvesant High School that you're talking about is right next to Ground Zero. And today we're going to move from one Ground Zero to another. We're going to talk about Jenin and the latest expose in an Israeli newspaper of an Israeli soldier and his role in the destruction of the refugee camp. This happens at a time when Israeli armed forces have attacked the Gaza Strip and invaded Jenin once again, invaded more West Bank cities after a second suicide bomb attack in Jerusalem in 2 days killed 6 Israelis and injured over 30. Helicopter gunships fired missiles in Gaza City and the southern Gaza town of Khan Yunis, killing at least 6 people. Troops backed by some 60 tanks and armored carriers and helicopters moved into Bethlehem from several directions. In Qalqilya, 2 Israeli soldiers were killed in a fierce gun battle at the home of a Palestinian Authority intelligence officer. The army also moved into the town Jenin and began rounding up hundreds of residents in its refugee camp. Israel invaded Ramallah, Hebron, and Dura as well, and has announced it will seize new Palestinian land in response to every future attack and hold it until the violence stops. No objection from Washington, which only a few weeks ago demanded that the Israeli prime minister withdraw his soldiers from parts of the West Bank controlled by the Palestinian Authority. Yasser Arafat today appealed to Palestinian militias to halt attacks on Israeli civilians, saying the shootings and bombings must be completely halted. Otherwise, he warned the result might be full Israeli occupation of our lands, he said. More than 50 Palestinians took out a full-page newspaper ad Wednesday condemning suicide bombings. We're joined right now first by Dalal Hassan, who is a student activist in Gaza, which has just been bombed, as well as Jim Davis, who is with the International Solidarity Movement in Jenin, which was just reoccupied. First to Dalal Hassan in Gaza. Can you tell us what it's like there now?
Right now, actually, we are standing on a region of the Gaza Strip called Beit Lahia. It's in North Gaza. It's right near a major settlement in the Gaza Strip called Eli Sinai. And what we're looking at is approximately something on the order of about the area of 4 football fields of land that was completely destroyed last night by Israeli bulldozers. And so we've been viewing, basically, it's a huge expanse of agricultural land that was used by local farmers here to grow produce, various types of produce. It's one of, this region is one of the most, the major income generating, the agriculture produced here is one of the major income generating projects in the Gaza Strip for the local residents. So right now around us there are also many of the local farmers here surveying the damage. Also on the hill, the only thing really left remaining is a huge greenhouse that that was the only thing they left remaining, but they told the farmers that if they did not move it by tonight, that it would also be destroyed. So there are a number of trucks and farmers that are scurrying about frantically trying to move it before they come out to destroy it again.
Gaza has largely escaped the invasions and the occupations and the city by city attacks of the Israelis. Are people there expecting that after these recent bombings in Jerusalem that it's going to be targeted more extensively now?
Well, I mean, I guess you haven't heard that last night it was targeted, and then there were attacks on Gaza, which we actually viewed. There were helicopters and F-16s firing on the Gaza Strip. We saw at least 4 to 5 missiles that were fired. We're actually hoping to be on our way to actually view the destruction of those attacks. So it's something, it's been the locations that we've heard are Khan Yunis, the Jabalia refugee camp, and Zaytuna were hit last night by Israeli fire. So it's actually not surprising to, it's not something that is unfamiliar to the residents of Gaza. They have been continuously ready and aware for these attacks to occur, although it doesn't always get covered.
Dalal Hassan, we have to break for stations to identify themselves. When we come back, we're going to go to Jenin and find out what has happened there with the reinvasion of Jenin, as well as a number of other West Bank towns, as well as the bombing and correction. The bombing of Gaza in Khan Yunis injured at least 6 people, did not kill them. You are listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
Say what we know is just what they teach us, and we're so ignorant, 'cause every time they can reach us through political strategy, they keep us hungry. And when you're gonna get some food, your brother got
You are listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We move from Gaza, which the Israeli military bombed yesterday, to Jenin, which they reinvaded. And we're joined by Jim Davis, who's an international solidarity activist there. Can you describe what has taken place now in Jenin?
About 50 tanks came in the night before last. After the camp had been attacked again by Apache helicopters, and the tanks rolled in. And since then, all day yesterday, soldiers went house to house, rounding up all the men between the ages of about 16 and 50. And they're doing that again this morning. The house that we're in here was raided about an hour ago by about 30 soldiers. So they're basically going around looking for all the young men. They're gathering them up, taking them to a school they've occupied just on the edge of the camp, where those guys are being held. Some are then being brought on to Salem, a town close by, where they're being brought to a regular prison. And others are being interrogated at the school. So there's been shooting and bombing all morning. I think a lot of the explosions we're hearing is doors being blown open and tank shells just being blown. And then gunfire, I think, to intimidate people to come out of their houses. And the soldiers are going around taking people in front of them, using them as human shields, to go into houses before the soldiers, and then they go in and search and look for, I assume they're looking for all the young men who are here, although there are very few. We haven't seen any young men around the camp.
And when you say that they came to the house that you are in, did they see you there? And what was their reaction to you being there?
Yeah, they did see us. I think they know why we're here. So they asked why we're here, and we said we were here just to, you know, to be with the families and to be present when the soldiers are coming into the houses, and to basically provide some solidarity for the families who are going through this, and to remember that all the men have been taken away, so it's basically young children and mothers and older women. So the kids are terrified, and of course there are thousands of kids here. So.
And how close are you to the Jenin refugee camp?
I'm in the camp. I'm right by, I'm in a house, one of the last houses standing by the area that was demolished in April.
In a minute, we're going to talk to the reporter who spoke to the Israeli soldier who described his role in the destruction of the camp that has caused quite a stir. Have you heard about this? Kurdi Bear, I think he asked to be called.
No, I haven't heard about him. What I did, there was a ceremony in, I think, in Jerusalem last week, and I read about it in a local newspaper, and it was presenting medals, you know, a military ceremony to present awards to some of the soldiers who were involved, among them the three tank drivers, and he was quoted saying that he you know, he would be given orders to go in, and that they would given the families would be ordered to evacuate, and he would be told to knock down this house, and this house, but, you know, he was very enthusiastic, and so he wouldn't even wait, and he would just go ahead and knock down as many houses as he could, and he sat in his truck his bulldozer for 70 hours, I think, and this is what he's interviewing now.
Right, we're going to talk to the reporter he spoke with, but we are joined on the line now by Shawki Issa, Executive Director of Law, the Palestinian Society for the Protection of Human Rights and the Environment. Israeli troops arrested him on Monday as he was heading into his office in Bethlehem, the soldier stopping his car at a checkpoint in the West Bank. Can you describe what happened to you and the overall situation right now, Shawki Issa?
Yes, this wasn't an isolated incident. They are targeting human rights lawyers and activists all the time. And the employees of our organization were targeted, and some of them were shot by rubber bullets during our work. Other field workers, their IDs were confiscated and their documents. So what happened with me is not isolated from that. They stopped me at a checkpoint near Hizma village when I was going to the office, and they claimed that I have false ID. Of course, it was clear that they just wanted to put obstacles for me not to go to the office and not to work, because they know me and they check my ID every day at checkpoints, and then I never had problems with this. And then they detained me and took me to Beit El settlement, where the military base there, for a few hours. They kept me under the sun, and then they even didn't say sorry. They just say, you can go now. So by the end of the day, they just let me go. And as you know, they do this always against journalists, against human rights activists, not only Palestinians, also Israeli human rights activists and foreign human rights activists were prevented from entering many areas in these periods of times.
Do you have any estimates of how many Palestinians are now in Israeli custody, still being detained?
Well, the number is moving every day, because since the beginning of these incursions, around 7,000 were detained. But they release people sometimes by 100 a day, but in the same time they detain others. From our work as lawyers, and we visit some of these detainees and talk to them, I can say that the Shabak doesn't have the capacity to deal with all these detainees, and they know that most of them, they mustn't be there. So they just keep them until they go through their files. So what's happening now, they give these detainees administrative detention for 3 months. We noticed many cases like this. They just give them the 3 months until they have a time to look through their files, and sometimes the next day after the decision to detain the person 3 months, they release him. The situation which concern us, the situation that these detainees are in is terrible, is horrifying. This famous Al-Afra jail now between Jerusalem and Ramallah, and the reopening of Ansar Katsuot jail in the desert south of Israel. The situation is very, very bad, and they have all these huge number of detainees they are not able to deal with. And the Red Cross even is not able or not allowed to visit. The parents, of course, at all, the families don't visit them. Many times they don't allow us to take medicine or clothes or any necessary needs for these prisoners. Many times they don't allow us to visit them. Many times the visit by the lawyer in a prison of the Shabak or the soldiers, and like 5-6 prisoners together. They don't give privacy to the lawyer and the prisoner. The military trials they do for these prisoners is just a show. It's like an offer, for example, they have 5-6 rooms for these military courts, and they are just soldiers playing the role of the judge, and it's like a market. There's nothing legal, no legal procedures, no nothing going on there. And anyone can play the role of the lawyer even, because you have nothing to do. They have everything decided, and the Shabak decided, not the judge.
Shoghi Issa, we are also joined on the line now by Tzadok Yeheskeli, who is a reporter with Yediot Aharonot, an Israeli newspaper, who had a piece that has been widely circulated in the newspaper, May 31st. It begins, Moshe Nissim, nicknamed Curdy Bear, the D9 operator who became the terror of the Jenin refugee camp inhabitants, speaks with no censorship about his time of glory. Quote, I entered Jenin driven by madness, by desperation. I felt I have nothing to lose, that even if I, quote, get it, no big deal. I told my wife, if anything happens to me, at least someone will take care of you. I started my reserve service in the worst conditions possible. Maybe this is why I didn't give a damn. Not about explosive charges, not about gunfire. My life was in deep bleep for the past 1.5 years. For almost half a year, I am suspended from work as a senior inspector in the Jerusalem municipality. I worked there for 17 years till that cursed day, January the 20th, exactly my 40th birthday, when the police came and arrested me. They said I and my colleagues in the inspection unit are suspected for being bribed by contractors and other business owners, that in fact, we are a corrupted bunch. So we went into the, he went into the Jenin refugee camp angry. And Tzadok Yeheskeli, maybe you could start off by telling us what he described to you about what he did there.
Well, what he was, he went there with his unit of D9 operators in the last few days of the Jenin battle, when just right after the Israel lost 13 of its soldiers in that Tuesday morning in an ambush. And I think that that was the, you know, the point, the low point of the battle from the Israeli point of view, when they got into, they realized that that they are risking, the fight is so fierce, and they are risking soldiers, and the only way is to finish it off was basically using those D9s, who are basically caterpillars that have heavy shields, and to basically send them to those houses where Palestinian fighters were shooting and were all booby-trapped. That's the only way that they felt that they can protect the soldiers. And he was describing basically, he was part of that unit, and he was describing how he would feel so great that he could save soldiers' life. He was saying that he was pulling his D9 into those houses that he was ordered to destroy, where a lot of ammunition, a lot of booby traps, and a lot of gunfire were shot from. And he, under his, the orders of his commanders, They would tremble those houses, try to start destroying them, and wait then a few minutes till those Palestinian fighters, if they were inside those houses, will come out, and they're calling them to come out. When they did not, or when nobody responded, they went on and destroyed the houses. Basically, those was the last 2-3 days of the fight where most of the destruction took place. And he was describing the fact that he, that was exceptional. The thing that was exceptional about him, that basically he didn't describe a different tale than his friends. I interviewed some of his operators, other operators as well, but that was unique about him, that he felt almost gleeful about him. They were saying how torn they were, that they had to destroy houses. But he said, and that was the exceptional thing about him, how he was almost gleeful. he thought that that's the right way to deal with the Palestinians there. And he also regretted that he couldn't have destroyed more houses.
Well, in your article, it seems that he's almost like a one-man wrecking crew, that he's constantly berating his commanders to let him go back out and destroy more houses, and that if they tell him to knock down one particular house, he takes delight in having in knocking down the houses around the target house. And it's a remarkable sort of admission of his own, as you say, his own enjoyment of the destruction process that went on.
Well, I think that that's the way he interpreted what he did there. I must tell you that, as far as I know, he says that in the article too, that he never did something that out of ordinary. He never went by himself. You must remember that there are two operators in each of those D9s, and he cannot work by himself. It's not like he's sending, he can do whatever he wants. He is fulfilling orders. And when they find a place where there is a lot of fire, they will send him and do it. I think that what he said, that when he had a chance to knock maybe another house on the way, or at least a few, if you, I've been in Jenin, and you have to imagine the situation. It's very dense. The houses are very close to each other, basically connected. And when you get into those places with a D9, with a huge, huge caterpillar, it's almost impossible not to knock out houses. And if you saw the destruction there, and I've seen it, it's in the last 2-3 days they did destruct, I would say, about 2 football fields in the middle of the camp, totally. And so he is, and there were not many D9s operating. So you can imagine what kind of destruction can a D9 cause. But I must remind you, those houses that they destructed were in the middle of the camp. Most of the Palestinian fighters really took hiding in those places. That was the last 2 days of the fight and the battle.
One of the things that has been fascinating to me in following the media coverage, both in this country and over the internet, when I review the Israeli press, is that the Israeli press often seems a lot more factual about what's going on there than the United States press here. I don't know how much of American coverage you've been able to to see, and I'm wondering if you have any perspective on that.
Well, I must tell you, I've been a correspondent in the United States for 12 years, and I've been in the United States a few months after the bombing of the 9/11, you know, but I must agree with you there. About there is something fascinating and I think very positive about the way the Israeli press is operating. Believe me, there is a patriotic wave in the United States and in Israel as well. I mean, Israel is under many people in Israel, you know, feel that they are under maybe one of the worst periods in our time. You can never know. I just came out of a coffee and drinking coffee in my office around Tel Aviv, and we talked about it. We don't know if we will come back to the office safe. So we have the same sense that we are under in the middle of a war. But the distinction is that the Israeli press is very, very independent. And they are not losing. We are not losing the focus on our basic, I would say, obligation to cover whatever is to be covered, and maybe criticize our military or criticize our government, or just report the fact as they are. I'm telling you, I was the first Israeli reporter covering from the Jenin, trying to find out what happened. Was there a massacre or not? And there was the Israeli army never cooperated with me. I had to get there by myself, risking my life. And I wrote the story, the first story, about the huge destruction. And I was very much disturbed by it. On the other hand, there was no massacre, and we reported that. But so I'm saying that in Israel, as tough the situation is, it may be, and it is, we still, I think, and we are independent. The press is independent, and we are not influenced by this patriotic wave. And I think that that in the United States, the place where we look to American press as something that we want to be like them, but in a way they are more, I think they're more influenced by this patriotic wave than we are. And I think Dan Rather, I think, spoke about it a few weeks ago,
right,
in 60 Minutes.
And with Greg Palast and BBC, Tzedek Yeheskeli, joining us, Israeli reporter and columnist. He also mentioned Caterpillar, the bulldozers that are being used in the Jenin refugee camp and other places from Caterpillar, Inc., which is in Peoria, Illinois. Shauki Issa, as you listen to this description of, well, he came to be known as Curdy Bear, that's what he wanted to be called, Moshe Nissim, who said he was angry and desperate when he went into this camp, actually wanted to put a flag on top of the mosque, but wasn't able to as he was destroying the various places within the Jenin refugee camp. What is your response as a resident of the West Bank?
Well, this is actually not the first time some of the Israelis who committed such a crime just spoke out. I remember 2 years ago an interview also in Israeli newspapers with the driver of another bulldozer who destroyed houses inside the old city of Jerusalem after the war in 67, where he also was proud to describe how he destroyed houses over the people inside the houses and killed them. And the interview with him was on the occasion that he got an award from the municipality. The history repeating itself since the establishment of Israel, they are continuing these crimes all the time. And we here in West Bank, we face these crimes every day, not only in Jenin. Maybe Jenin was the biggest in the present time, but they also destroyed the whole city of Nablus. They destroyed houses in other refugee camps in Bethlehem and Hebron and Ramallah and other places. And this shows the mentality of these people, soldiers or drivers of bulldozers during the military operations. And it's true the Israeli media writes about it more than the American media, but still the average Israeli reads most about the justifications of these crimes. And the discussions going on now in Israel shows how confused the Israelis, that everybody understands that there is only one solution for the whole conflict, is to end the occupation, but they don't want it. So this is why they are confused and trying to find other ways other than the only solution. And this is how they are failing all the time. And with all the measures they've taken, they can't stop or prevent anything against the Israelis. And I would like to say to all Israelis, the only way to have security for them and for us is to end the occupation. There is no other way.
I must, if you may, let me add one point here. And I think it should be said that I really wait for the moment that the Palestinian press and the Palestinian media will interview, as I did, and it wasn't the great coup of public relations for Israel, as you probably know. Of course, I'm very cynical here. But I'm waiting for the Palestinian press to interview a future somebody that went to and helped those suicide bombers that killed 19 people just the other day, to describe the way that he was gleeful, maybe, about going and killing those people. So I want to be very balanced here, as we are self-criticizing ourselves. I think I'm not sure that the Palestinian as well, and I'm looking in the media, doing the same with people that are, believe me, are involved in not less horrible crimes than this guy Kurdi, which never saw anybody that was killed. And so I'm not even trying to compare, but you have to be fair and look at your press as well, that is that has a very, very, very long way to go before it can even say something like criticizing the Israelis here. So we have to put a balance. We have to remember what's going on in our streets every day, and you have to put it in context.
Shaki Issa?
Well, I believe just today and yesterday there were big ads in the local newspapers in Palestine against the suicide bombs. And this appears many times in the Palestinian media. And everybody lives here knows that the majority are not supporting the suicide bombs. But in the same time, everybody connect this and put the responsibility of all this by both sides on the occupation. So we don't like to see Israeli civilians killed, and we don't like to see Palestinian civilian killed, and we don't like to see Palestinians continue suffering all the time because of the occupation. So we connect everything with the occupation, and we believe that the end of the occupation will solve all the problem and give security to both civilians, Israelis and Palestinians.
On that note,
the Palestinian media writes about that all the time.
On that note, I want to thank you both for being with us. Shaki Issa, Executive Director of Law, the Palestinian Society for the Protection of Human Rights and the Environment, speaking to us from the West Bank, and Sadok Yeheskeli, who is a reporter with Yediot Aharonot, one of Israel's two most widely circulated newspapers, recently published the interview with the Israeli reserve soldier who talked about his role in the destruction of the Jenin refugee camp. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll be joined by Vermont Congressmember Bernie Sanders as the administration continually talks about the so-called war on terror. What's happening here at home with housing, with health care? And what about the GOP fundraiser last night where drug companies paid up to $250,000 to have a place at the table? Stay with us.
We got politicians running races on corporate cash. Now don't tell me they don't turn around and kiss them people's ass. You may call me old-fashioned, that don't fit my picture of a true democracy. It feels like I am living in the wasteland of the free. We got CEOs making 200 times the workers' pay. But they'll fight like hell against raising the minimum wage. If you don't like it, mister, they'll ship your job to some third world country across the sea. And it feels like I am living in the wasteland of the free.
Iris Dement singing Wasteland of the Free. And hello to all our KKFI listeners in Kansas City and to the folks at Leavenworth, particularly Leonard Peltier listening on KKFI. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. Pharmaceutical companies paid as much as $250,000 for a place near the president's table at a multi-million-dollar GOP fundraiser last night. This just 2 days after Republicans unveiled a prescription drug plan the industry's backing. Republican officials declined to disclose the donors to the Washington event hosted by President George Bush. But people familiar with the dinner said drug companies are among the biggest contributors, with GlaxoSmithKline, Pfizer, and Pharma all paying the big ticket prices. The party should have netted as much as $30 million from the event. The proceeds will be split between Republicans' House and Senate campaign committees. Drug company executives flocked to last night's fundraiser, just as Congress is taking up legislation to create a prescription drug benefit for the elderly. Pharmaceutical companies have been lobbying aggressively to make sure the plan does not significantly lower the cost of prescription drugs. And so far, Republicans have not disappointed the industry. Earlier this week, GOP lawmakers proposed a bill that would cover only a fraction of a senior's first $4,000 in drug costs. Critics say the plan leaves seniors dependent on private insurers and stuck with huge out-of-pocket costs. The House Energy and Commerce Committee debated the Republican plan yesterday, but broke early so GOP lawmakers could attend the drug-backed gala. They are expected to resume discussion today. We're joined on the phone now by Vermont Congressmember Bernie Sanders, who's just flown in from Britain, where he was testifying before Parliament on Gulf War syndrome. Is that right, Congressman
Correct.
Sanders?
Yes, that's right.
Well, can you give us your take on what has been happening in Washington?
Yeah, I think the first thing that we need to know is, in my view, the pharmaceutical industry is by far the most powerful lobby in the country. They never lose. And the reason that we as Americans end up paying by far the highest prices in the world for prescription drugs, in some cases 10 times more for the same exact drug, is because of the huge power that the industry has over the United States Congress. And what we should also know is that every single year, while elderly people suffer and cut their pills in half and take money from their food budget, every single year the pharmaceutical industry leads all other industries in terms of the rates of profits that they make, and at the same time they pay their CEOs outrageous compensation packages. So this is one industry which is doing very well at the expense of the American people.
And of course, when you talk to most union leaders or people negotiating contracts, they all talk about the biggest problem in terms of healthcare benefits is the rocketing, escalating cost of prescription drugs. And clearly it's become a huge issue in the heartland of the United States, especially for those who are not in unions and
That's
therefore
right.
don't even have paid health
well,
plans.
All over the country, what you're seeing is small businesses unable to provide any health insurance for their workers or for themselves. You're seeing prescription drugs being the catalyst for a situation in which in 10 years from now, the cost of healthcare in this country is going to double. So you're absolutely right in saying, number one, it's an outrage unto itself, and number two, unless we get a handle on it, healthcare costs in this country are going to go completely off the roof.
So what are the Democrats offering in response?
Well, for a number of years, we as progressives are making the following point. If you go across the Canadian border, you can pick up, in the case of, say, tamoxifen, which is widely prescribed for breast cancer, you can pick up that drug for one-tenth the price. Similar situations exist in Mexico and in Europe as well. So we said, if you develop strong cost containment, number one, if you put pressure on the industry and you substantially lower the cost of drugs, you can come up with a strong prescription drug benefit under Medicare. The Democrats have not gone as far as I would like to go in cost containment, but they have come forward at least kicking and screaming with a serious prescription drug benefit under Medicare, which would help a whole lot of people. The Republican plan, as I think you've indicated a moment ago, is incredibly weak. It will not do anything to lower the cost of prescription drugs. For somebody, say, who has to spend $4,000 on prescription drugs, they're still going to be continuing to spend an enormous amount of money. It will help, but help just a little. Also, their proposal is not within Medicare. They're going to involve the insurance companies to provide benefits, and we're not clear what that means. But there is no doubt in anybody's mind that what the Republicans are doing is directly at the behest of the industry, and the industry will tell you that.
Take a listen for a minute to Jeffrey Truitt, spokesperson for Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers Association, Pharma, big payers last night for the GOP fundraiser. He wouldn't come on with you, but he did have this response to the criticism.
My name is Jeff Truitt, and I'm spokesman for the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America. The research-based pharmaceutical and biotechnology industry believes very strongly that it should be considered an urgent national priority that Congress should get together on a bipartisan agreement for drug coverage under a reformed Medicare program. And we stress the words reformed Medicare program because we believe very strongly that Medicare needs to be more responsive to the needs of patients. It needs to be more responsive to the needs of Medicare patients. And so we think that the program should be reformed and that there should be a transition to much more marketplace competition and choice under the auspices of the program.
That's Jeffrey Truitt of the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America. Your response, Congressmember
Sanders? Well, that's a very honest response. When they talk about reform, what they ultimately mean, and that's what he said, is the privatization of Medicare. And the same mentality, of course, exists in terms of reform of Social Security means the destruction of Social Security. If you believe that senior citizens should be guaranteed specific benefits in terms of healthcare and prescription drugs, as I do, then we have to put more money into Medicare, and we have to lower the cost of the prescription drugs and develop a strong prescription drug benefit under Medicare. What this guy is saying is, ultimately, let's privatize Medicare. Let the private insurance companies provide undefined benefits. And as part of that, let us make sure that because the government is minimally involved, that we will never lower the cost of prescription drugs in this country for the seniors or for anybody else. What these guys stay up nights in trepidation about is that the United States government do with the Canadians what every country in Europe does and sit down and negotiate with the industry as to the kinds of prices that they can charge. We are the only country in the industrialized world that does not do that. If you get the government out of the picture and you just have the private insurance companies in there, that will not happen, and they will be able to continue to rip off the American people.
Congressman Sanders, a quick point on housing, because you're introducing some legislation today. President Bush apparently is now talking about why they hate us, the culprit real estate envy. You know what they hate? President George Bush said this week, speaking of the perpetrators of terror attacks, they hate the idea that somebody can go buy a home. Your response in terms of the legislation you've
just introduced? Well, my response is that unfortunately there are millions and millions of Americans who cannot buy a home. My response is that we have large numbers of working families who are sleeping in their cars or sleeping in their streets, and that in fact we have a major housing crisis in communities from one end of this country to the other. And unfortunately, what Mr. Bush and his friends would prefer to do is give hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars in tax breaks to the wealthiest 1%, rather than build the kind of affordable housing that we need in this country to take care of the needs of working families.
What are you doing about it?
I'm out of this office in 2 minutes going to a meeting where we are going to be introducing legislation that has a whole lot of support. And we've had the Low Income Housing Coalition do a tremendous job gaining us national support for a proposal which would put about $26 billion into affordable housing in the next 5 years through a national affordable housing trust fund. To say that given the crisis that we have in this country, you need a trust fund where money is dedicated. Dedicated funds go into affordable housing to protect the lowest income people and working families all over this country. And that issue is going to be debated in about 5 minutes.
And one quick question. In terms of, I saw recently that the House and Senate have passed a bill that basically would insure the entire insurance industry of the United States against catastrophic losses from further terrorist attacks. Your sense of that bill and what whether it was right to do that?
Well, it's a complicated issue. Probably don't have the time to go into it now, but I'm always amazed to the degree which the United States Congress is very worried about the insurance industry and tax breaks for the wealthy and for the credit card companies rather than for the needs of working people. If the degree to which the federal government gets involved in these things, taxpayers should be helped substantially, but that often does not happen. So these things become forms of just corporate welfare.
Mm-hmm. Congressmember Bernie Sanders, independent of Vermont, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. You are listening to Democracy Now! As we wrap up tomorrow on Democracy Now!, Howard Zinn will be joining us in the studio talking about war and terror. And next week, we're going to speak with Israeli and Palestinian filmmakers who've been showing their films at the Human Rights Watch International Film Festival. Among them, Rachel Leah Jones, our very own filmmaker here at Democracy Now! Her film is 500 Dunams on the Moon, and she just had a big write-up in the New York Times about 500 Dunhams. So check that out this week. That does it for the program Democracy Now!, produced by Chris Abrams, Miranda Kennedy, Lizzie Ratner, and Michael Yeh. Anthony Sloan is our engineer and music maestro. Our website is democracynow.org. You can email us at mail@democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with El Presidente Juan Gonzalez. You've been listening to Democracy Now!